This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, editor at the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Crawford Gribben, professor of history at Queen's University Belfast and a host on the New Books Network. We're discussing Crawford's new book, J.N. Darby and the Roots of Dispensationalism. John Nelson Darby was a writer and Bible teacher whose work has had a profound influence on various schools of Christianity. In this book, Crawford explores Darby's ideas and how he's been critically misinterpreted. Crawford, thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Caleb. It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. You know, I love talking to hosts because they know exactly how NBN interviews go. So there's really not much trouble in getting going. This was a topic that I found interesting. I didn't know it a ton about. I had a friend in high school who he converted to Calvinism, and I learned a little bit about Protestantism from him. He had like a literal come to Jesus moment, and he taught me a lot about Calvinism and Christianity and offshoots of Protestantism. So this was definitely a new topic for me, but one that is definitely very fascinating. But before jumping into the topic, I just wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, thanks, Caleb. Well, as you mentioned there, my current job is to teach history at Queen's University in Belfast, which is in Northern Ireland. And I've been there for about maybe 11 years, something like that. Before that, I've had a bit of a checkered history. I used to teach English literature at University of Manchester, Trinity College Dublin. That was a lot of fun for about maybe 14 years or 15 years, something like that. So that takes me back to the 1990s when I was doing my PhD. My PhD was about Puritans, so the more radical Protestants of the 17th century and their views of the end of the world. And I was writing about people like Oliver Cromwell, John Milton, John Bunyan, would be some of the key names in that. And over the last 25 years then, I sustained this interest both in Puritanism as a subject, but also in the broader subject of how Protestants have thought about the end of the world. And I suppose over the last 2.5 decades, I've done a number of books which have tried to explore that in different ways. I'm interested in it partly historically, but also because of its contemporary relevance. So we're recording this during the war in Gaza, and episodes like that are often understood by the general public in terms of how they play out certain kinds of prophetic narratives, biblical prophetic narratives. So yeah, the subject we're talking about today is really abstruse and maybe really niche. But hopefully we'll see later on, it does have some quite significant real world consequences today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, one of the beauties of history is being able to look at something in the past and seeing the ways in which things that happened before, rhyme with what's going on today. And for this particular book, you know, as you said, you were studying different things, but how did you come to write this book and to look at the life of John Nelson Darby?
Yeah, thanks, Caleb. Well, as I said, over the last 25 years or so, I've written a number of books which have looked at episodes in this long tradition. So I did a book with Palgrave Macmillan back about maybe 2011 called Evangelical Millennialism in the Transatlantic World, 1500 to 2000. That was an attempt to write a big survey of how these end of the world ideas developed, mutated, and how they've been applied in various cultural, political moments. And then in addition to that sort of big overarching narrative, I've tried to think about particular episodes, mainly 17th century, some 18th century, a number 20th and 21st century. But this really was my attempt to look at probably the most important 19th century figure in this tradition. So all of these books, in a way, they sort of stack up to create a bigger story. The current book that we're talking about, J.N. Darby and the Roots of Dispensationalism, as I say, is an attempt to critically analyse the theologian who probably has had most influence, both in terms of popular perceptions of Protestant ideas of the end of the world, and also how those have played out in social, cultural, political contexts.
So with that back, you know, your personal background, you know, that makes quite a bit of sense. And I find that a lot when talking to scholars, that there is this this sort of you're slowly working your way through history, hitting the different parts and seeing for yourself as you move to the present day, which is fun. But I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about who, just in broad strokes, who John Nelson Darby was, and a little bit about maybe his early life, the context in which he was raised.
Yeah, great. Well, he was born in London, 1800, died in London, 1882. But in between, he lived a very remarkable life, really. He was probably one of the 19th century's most travelled and most widely published individuals. He wrote something in the region of 19 million words. He travelled extensively in the 1830s and 40s across French-speaking Europe. And from the 1860s, he made, or mid-1860s, he made, I think, 7 transatlantic trips and spent most of the later part of the 60s and through the 70s in North America. From North America, he jumped in a boat to New Zealand and Australia. So, you know, he really did travel the world. And one of the reasons why he was such a good traveler is because he was such a good linguist. He translated the Bible into English, both Hebrew Bible and Greek New Testament, into French and German. He participated in translation into Italian. In addition to preaching in those 4 languages, he also preached in Irish, in Dutch, and also apparently when he went to New Zealand, in Maori. So he was someone who really was able to absorb language and enjoy language. His personal library amounted to several thousand volumes when it was sold after his death. And it's really remarkable for the kinds of things it includes. It's got material in the history of Hinduism, for example, also on the history of Indo-European language structures, you know, all these kinds of really particular aspects of Victorian intellectual culture. He's interested in everything, but fundamentally, he's a preacher. Fundamentally, what his life is about is trying to explain the Bible to people and look after the people who come to see it the way that he does.
How did Darby's views evolve as a young man? What did he initially, what type of Christianity was he initially associated with, and how did he begin to develop his own thought?
Well, Darby grew up in a family that was not really known for its religious interests. His father was of a kind of nominal Church of England background. His mother was actually an American Unitarian, part of the Vaughan family. Anne Vaughan was her name. The Vaughan family had excellent connections to Benjamin Franklin. I think one of the brothers had participated in the architectural planning of Philadelphia. You know, they had significant slave holdings in the Caribbean. Very, very wealthy transatlantic family. And Darby was born into this family. As I say, his father an Anglican, his mother a Unitarian. So he grows up in London in the early 1800s. Is sent to Westminster School, which is one of the top private schools in the city at that time. And then at the age of 15, is sent to Dublin to study at Trinity College Dublin, where he studies classics. And in 1819, he graduates from Trinity with a gold medal in classics. So he's one of the very best students of Greek and Latin literature in the college at that time. He's sent to Dublin, I think, because the family had extensive connections with Ireland. They had estates in Ireland as well as estates in England. And as a consequence, Darby really began to put down some roots in Ireland. His mother, his sister was married to an up-and-coming lawyer. He had a couple of older brothers who had put down roots in Ireland as well. And so I think Darby saw that as a sensible place to begin his career as a younger son in that family. So he began to study law, eventually became a barrister. But by the early 1820s, had really convinced himself that a career in law was not going to be for him, because he was worried, being a deeply moral young man, he was worried that he'd be using his talents to defeat good in the service of finance, really, whoever's paying his bills. So he then quit his career in law, I think much to his father's concern, and decided to prepare to become a priest in the Church of Ireland. Now, Darby in the 1820s would really have seen himself as a priest. He belonged to a party within the Church of Ireland that was a bit like the party forming in England at the same time called the Oxford Movement. So very, very high church, very interested in liturgy, very Catholic aesthetically, though not theologically, very Protestant theologically, but very Catholic in terms of style, liturgy, garments, all of that kind of thing. And that's how Darby began his ministerial career. He was sent to quite a tough rural parish, not very many Church of Ireland people in it, as far as we can tell, but a lot of very poor Catholics. And remember, in Ireland in the mid-1820s, poverty is just extraordinary. So that I think in even by the middle of the 19th century, around 50% of the inhabitants of the island were living in what were essentially mud huts. Cabins, turf cabins, they were called, they were literally made of mud. So those are the kinds of people that Darby was ministering to. And he was going about, obviously, with quite a high view of the sacraments, a high view of the church and so on. But he wrote later on, he wasn't absolutely sure that he was a Christian himself. So although he was really trying to look after people as best he could, he was really worried about whether he was going to heaven. And so he was out one day on his horse, had an accident, crushed his foot against a post, I think, and actually had to go and recuperate in his sister's house. And so away from his parish duties and lying in bed for a couple of months, hobbling about the city in a crutch for a couple of months, he really devoted himself to reading the Bible. And as he did that, he went through a religious crisis and probably what we would call now a conversion experience, so that he emerged out of that period of convalescence as a completely different kind of Christian. No longer interested in liturgy, very high views of church or sacraments, and much more like your friend who converted to Calvinism, kind of red hot, evangelical, Protestant, certainly, but passionately committed to the Calvinist Reformation. And he begins then to associate himself with a number of other earnest young men in Dublin who had gone through a similar kind of experience. Some of them were Catholic in background, some of them were Church of Ireland, some were congregational, but they all come together and they begin to express frustration that Christianity, the Christian church, has become so divided by these different churchly traditions, and they want to meet together just as Christians. Now, there's a kind of a temperamental thing going on here. I think this is late Romanticism playing out in some ways in religious terms, an idea that Christians can somehow just divest themselves of all the accretions of church history and go back to some original pure moment. And if that was Darby's thought in the 1820s, he very quickly abandoned it because he realized that even if the Church of the Acts of the Apostles is the pattern and standard by which all subsequent Christianity could be measured or should be measured, that pattern or standard could never be repristinated. So he developed this idea that the church was ruined and that the church could never go back to being this pure, original, beautiful thing. And then it became his mission in life to try to gather earnest Christians from the mess of the denominations, to unite them together simply as Christians, to wait for the return of Jesus. And so one of the things I argue in the book is that after Darby has this conversion to evangelicalism in the late 1820s, he develops a theology which changes over time, but which can broadly be described as Calvinist in its doctrine of salvation, Catholic, small c Catholic in its understanding of the church, charismatic in its view of the Holy Spirit, because he expects the work of the Holy Spirit to continue, and finally catastrophic in that even from the moment of his conversion, Darby is really persuaded the world is about to end, Jesus is about to come back. And even though he changes his views on that over the years, he remains really convinced that the end of all things is at hand.
One of the organizations that he was heavily involved with is the Plymouth Brethren. And I was wondering if you'd talk about the Plymouth Brethren and what they believe.
Yeah, thanks, Caleb. That's right. So Darby, after about 1830, he leaves Ireland, moves to England for a while, associates with these red-hot Calvinists in the University of Oxford, but then through them gets introduced to a little community of believers with similar kinds of values that established itself in Plymouth. Now, the congregation in Plymouth that shared these ideas grew really, really rapidly in the late 1830s, early 1840s, grew to about 1,000 people, which would have made it a really significant congregation in terms of size at that time. So the funny thing is that although Darby was essentially Irish in terms of family background and personal preference probably too, the movement that he came to lead was identified by the name of this English town, Plymouth. So the Plymouth Brethren were really the Brethren, the Brothers as they called themselves, the Brethren in 19th century terminology, who were associated with this congregation in Plymouth that took on these characteristics that Darby and other Bible teachers within that community were trying to develop or encourage people to adopt. So they were, as a community, strongly, we might say, egalitarian or anti-clerical, in that they did not believe that a person, or a man, I should say, should need to be ordained before he either preached in public or administered the sacraments. They were very, very focused on the return of Jesus. That was a really driving theme, like a lot of other groups in that period, but for them it's a real driving theme. They're committed to simplicity of life, which often means for people who join the movement in the 1830s, early 1840s, that they give up the trappings of wealth. So it's kind of funny, because one of the key ways you can identify a Brethren household in the 1840s was by the absence of carpets or curtains. And the Plymouth Church becomes a kind of fulcrum of this movement. They have an auction, a three-day auction sometime in the early 1840s. And it takes 3 days for them to sell all the luxury goods they want to get rid of, because they really want to use the financial value of these goods for the good of humanity through the spreading of the gospel. So that's very much how they see themselves. Now, the community grows. It becomes international. It suffers a devastating split in the late 1840s, which leads it to move in two different directions. One group called the Open Brethren is very much outward facing, and it engages very easily with broader cultures of evangelicalism, to such an extent that it loses a lot of what made the movement initially quite distinct. The other group, called the Exclusive Brethren, which Darby came to lead, was much more differentiated, much more particular, retained the original emphases much more clearly and in a much more sustained way. They went through several crises of their own in the decades that followed, but they really are the group that we can identify as the followers of J.N. Darby.
What were the core contributions to biblical study that Darby had? As you said, he wrote 19 million words, which is absolutely absurd. I mean, I'm trying to imagine what 19 million words looks like in pages, and it must be hundreds of thousands of pages. What were his core contributions to biblical study, and really what made his ideas so revolutionary?
Well, his core contribution is often thought to be that he was the founder or father or architect, the metaphor changes, of a system of theology known as dispensational premillennialism. Big convoluted term, which basically means that the story of redemption in the Bible can be divided up into seven distinct periods of time, the last of those being the 1,000-year period in which Jesus reigns over the earth, probably from the city of Jerusalem, depending on your version of that scheme that you adopt. So that's generally what historians say. Darby's the father of dispensational premillennialism, and that dispensational premillennialism then becomes the dominant version of eschatology, end times thinking, and popular Protestantism, especially in the United States, through the 20th and 21st century. One of the things I'm arguing in my book, Caleb, is that that narrative is wrong, that Darby is not the father of this system of theology. He might be its grandfather, or at most its uncle, but he's probably not his father. And the reason I say that is because this idea of dividing biblical history up into seven periods of time was well established before Darby ever began to write anything about it. And so what makes Darby revolutionary is not what people think makes Darby revolutionary, because the revolution had already happened in a way. What makes Darby revolutionary is that he said it should not be divided up into seven periods of time, but probably only three, something like that. So he has a completely different way of viewing how biblical history works. So it's curious then to work out how is it that literally generations of historians have assumed the opposite and have assumed that he is the father or the architect, the founder of this system, when actually he was challenging it. And I think the only way that we can understand that is to realize that we as historians do what all other historians do, which is to rely on other people's work instead of going back to read the primary sources ourselves. And when we do that, you know, I've done that, lots of other people do that. We always rely on each other, but when we do rely on each other uncritically, then we can begin to establish narratives that are actually not accurate. So I'm trying in the book to argue that, yes, Darby was revolutionary, not because he founded the seven epochal system of reading biblical history, but because he challenged it. However, his challenge was forgotten, and he was very quickly subsumed into the broader story that he set out to deny.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, how this happens, that there's the confusion comes from not looking at the primary sources, but just relying on secondary sources. I'm wondering, you know, what you think is some of the cause of that people neglected that. And in your work, what helped you kind of realize that some of the assumptions people made about Darby were wrong? Were there particular sections or passages or things that you read that helped that click for you?
Yeah, great question, Caleb. I mean, I suppose we, as I said before, we all do this. Every one of us who's an historian depends on other people's footnotes and takes for granted, I suppose, a lot of what other people have said. And the more that people say something, the more true it becomes. Now, Darby's not an easy read, and his writings are not especially revealing in terms of how they're organized in the collected writings, 34 volume set, published from 1866 to 1883 or 1884, I think. You know, they're poorly put together, they're poorly edited. The man who edited them took real liberties with the text, changed titles, adjusted the text of items, added explanatory material, took away material, sometimes highlighted that, sometimes didn't highlight that. So editorially, they're a little bit of a mess. They're not really something that a historian could rely on. And the thing is, with those texts, they are edited in such a way as to give the impression that Darby was much clearer in his early years of his later conclusions than he actually was. So there's a kind of a retroactive redaction to make to always bring Darby up to date with later conclusions. So one of the things I tried to do in the book then was to jump back from the collected writings edition to look at original publications where I could find them. And at various stages in the book, I tried to note some of the differences between original publications and the text as it's most commonly accessed in the collected writings. So historians depend on the collected writings. You know, we assume when we see a 19th century edition that it's broadly accurate, but actually this is one of the least accurate 19th century editions I've come across. And you know, it's a text that's designed to lead the reader towards certain kinds of conclusions, which is generally what's happened. So Darby's works are hard to read, but they're also just hard to understand. And he's not an organized thinker. He doesn't set out his views and say, here's three reasons why I believe everyone else is wrong. Here's three alternatives to these three reasons. He's not like that. He's not systematic. He's very impressionistic. He says famously, the pen is a great aid to the head. In other words, he thinks on paper. And so, you know, the challenge of reading Darby is always to think, well, when did he write this? And how does this big argument fit into the broader patterns of his thought? Because sometimes he will argue things that he later doesn't want to argue. And, you know, he's someone who will go back to books, edit them, rewrite sections and republish them under the same title, which means that the same Darby book might exist in three different or four different editions under the same title, and you've got to figure out, well, which one actually is the one to prefer. So I think those are some of the challenges, really, when we look at Darby. And so it's no great surprise that for 20 years, I relied on other people. When I began reading Darby, I didn't think he was different from what I'd been told he was. But gradually, as I worked my way chronologically through his works, it became obvious to me that actually he was much more interesting than I had anticipated, because he was much more different. He was entirely different from what I had been led to believe and what I had led other people to believe, because I too was one of those people who relied on others' conclusions and didn't do the reading. But when I did do the reading, this was what came up.
After your reading of Darby, seeing his complexity, seeing his variety of thought that had been brushed over, which is so common with so many thinkers, because people try and use them to, you know, marshal them as this this person that they can this expert that they can rely on, or this this source that that they can point to as the source of truth on a matter. But you know, now having done your correctives, and I'm sure you're still reading him after this, what aspects of his thought connect with you the most? You know, what are some of his ideas that that you find yourself thinking about and chewing on?
Thanks, Caleb. That's a great question. Darby's obviously a Christian theologian, and he is moved as he writes about Jesus Christ. And I think that's really obvious. So I'm a Christian historian, not a Christian theologian, but I share his interest in Jesus Christ. And I find it very affecting to read Darby, especially when he talks about the sufferings of Christ and what Jesus has done what it meant for Jesus to be the incarnate Word of God, what it meant for him to live in this world that he had created that was going to rack and ruin, what it meant for him to experience suffering so that he could redeem people. You know, as Darby writes about that, I think it's very difficult not to be moved. And the funny thing is, Caleb, when he writes about those kinds of themes, he's often saying things that are common to all Christians or to Christians of many different denominational backgrounds. So the part for me where Darby, I think, is most effective as a writer is actually when he's most generically Christian, if that makes sense. But I think, you know, when he writes about that, it can be especially moving. Darby was a poet. In addition to his translating and theologizing and commentating and so on, he wrote a lot of poems, and some of his poems, which focus on the person and work of Jesus Christ, I think just encapsulate the movement of his emotions as he begins to think through some of these issues.
So you have a sort of a Darby as an artist reading, that he's this less a systematic religious thinker and more of a kind of a poet or a painter, like maybe a Da Vinci in a sense.
That's a really interesting way to think about him. I mean, he's not a systematic theologian. He wouldn't have claimed to be. I don't think his mind was organized in those kinds of categorical or conceptual ways. That wasn't the way he approached things. He feels, you know, you can see his feeling a great deal. And I like the idea of him being a poet of theology. I think that makes sense. There's a kind of a almost mystical aspect to Darby as well, you know. He's very meditative often in the way that he works. A fascinating character.
You mentioned earlier the split of the Plymouth Brethren and Darby coming to lead one of the groups, the Exclusive Brethren. Could you talk a little about this split and some of the controversies that occurred in Darby's life and how he handled those?
Yeah, so the split, as I mentioned, occurred in Plymouth, or was focused in Plymouth, although it had ramifications across the Brethren movement nationally, across Britain and Ireland, and also internationally into French-speaking Europe. The split was focused in Plymouth, and it was really a split that highlighted the personality clash between Darby, who was this, as I say, quite spontaneous, often quite informal, I think also often quite humble individual, who was used to working with very poor people. A split between him and the leader of the church in Plymouth, a man called Benjamin Wills Newton, who was an Oxford fellow, extremely cerebral, very, very clever, absolutely prepared to think in categorical, conceptual terms. Very different kind of thinker from Darby, very different kind of person from Darby, a little bit younger, was for some time under Darby's shadow, but when Darby goes to Europe, Benjamin Wills Newton really begins to blossom as a church leader. But as he does that, and he's a man of really remarkable pulpit gifts, it's him that pulls this congregation of 1,000 people together. So he's obviously an able orator, as well as being a very astute theologian. As he is flowering in terms of his ministry, and gathering literally 1,000 people to listen to him. Darby's in Europe talking to groups of 10, 20, 15. He's marching through the Alps. He marches 20 miles by day, preaches at night to a couple of families on a remote farm, marches 20 miles, does the same thing the next night, and packs all his goods into a little haversack or a rucksack that he walks about with. So the two men are totally different. So when Darby comes back in the early 1840s to Plymouth, he sees that Plymouth has really changed. It's become bigger. As it's become bigger, in a way, it's become too big for the Brethren ideal. It's easy in some remote, Swiss farm to preach a kind of anti-clerical message or to have a very simple gathering of Christians. But when you've got 1,000 people sitting in a congregation, somebody's got to organize them. So the two men are in very different social contexts. They share the same theology, at least they did at that point. But as they come back together, the personality clash, I think, begins to happen. And as that happens, their ideas, they always had slightly different ideas, but those ideas become more important for each of them. And so what I think starts off as a personality clash becomes a theological dispute. Very common way of working out a difference in personalities, isn't it? It's not about us. It's about the ideas we hold and his are wrong. And as that happens, I think then a number of key concepts begin to be defined. And one of those key concepts, which has got massive consequence, even to the present day, is Darby's revision of the end times thinking that the Brethren had when they began. So when the Brethren began, the expectation was that normal life would continue. At some point, an Antichrist figure would be revealed. There'd be about 7 years of turmoil and difficulty that would follow that. And then Jesus would come back and set up his kingdom. But Darby began to change his mind in that view. And he began to argue that view was wrong. He began to argue that actually there was no signs of the times to look for, that at any moment Jesus could return. And after Jesus returned in this event that becomes later on known as the rapture, after Jesus returns in the rapture to take all true believers away, then the Antichrist rises. Then this period of persecution begins. Then 7 years later, Jesus returns, executes judgment on Antichrist and his supporters and so forth, and sets up his 1,000-year kingdom. So that's quite a subtle distinction, we might say, between two versions of essentially the same theology, a premillennial theology, a theology that expects Jesus to reign on earth or his power to be exercised on earth for 1,000 years. But that distinction became a litmus test then for who was committed to Benjamin Wills Newton's leadership and who would be committed to the leadership of John Nelson Darby. So Darby says in his private letters, listen, this dispute is not about end times thinking. It's about other kinds of issues. And there were other issues. Benjamin Wills Newton, although a very charismatic preacher, had begun to make some claims about the doctrine of Christ, the traditional Orthodox Christology, that were thought to be heretical and probably were, because he later withdrew them. So Darby was competing against those, challenging those, at the same time developing a different view of end times theology. And as that happened, the two men really began to part ways. And Darby called for decisive disciplinary action against Newton. A number of people supported him in that call. Those who did became known as Exclusive Brethren. Those who didn't remained neutral, or perhaps supporters of Newton, and they went eventually in a very different destination. So this idea that Darby develops in the late 1840s, this idea of a secret rapture, an imminent rapture, is an idea that's become a meme in American popular culture. And, we could look at songs by Sonic Youth. We could look at episodes of The Simpsons. We could look at the HBO series, The Leftovers. There's lots and lots of examples of this way outside the culture of, evangelicalism. But when we look inside the culture of evangelicalism, we can also look at examples like the Left Behind novels, which have sold over 80 million copies, published between 1995 and I think about 2008. They spawned off a sequence of big screen films, the most recent of which in 2014 starred none less than Nicolas Cage. We all enjoy a good Nicolas Cage movie. So, there's a number of really interesting pop culture manifestations of this idea, and it's being hammered out in the controversy between Newton and Darby in Plymouth in the late 1840s.
At least in American politics, it's totally an unavoidable facet of the way that people talk about American politics, about whether or not one politician or another is this, you know, the supposed Antichrist, and whether or not it's the sign of end of days. You know, thus far, you know, the difference between a seven days of supposed hell on earth followed by rapture versus a imminent rapture, I could see why that would be a cause of controversy, because it would completely change how you're interpreting the world around you. So it's quite an interesting controversy, and it's definitely one that has quite a bit of relevance today still, like you said. And I was thinking of the show The Leftovers when you mentioned it. You know, when you look at Darby's ideas today, what are some of the main relevance that you see? Obviously, you know, that particular example of the rapture, but are there other things about Darby's thought that you think are quite interesting, or things that that have an influence that are worth looking into?
It's a great question, Caleb, because I'm sure if Darby did some kind of time transport and came to 2024 when we record this conversation, he would look at the state of the church and say there's nothing here that corresponds to what I've taught. But actually, I think as historians, we can trace legacies. Now, the legacies might not be legacies that he wanted, but I think they are legacies. So, you know, we can look at popular evangelicalism, especially in the United States. And, it does tend to be quite suspicious of clerical status, claims to authority. It's very prone towards revivalistic individualism. Its focus on signs of the times, we're recording this in April 2024. Recently, there was a total solar eclipse across the United States. And some people within this community, or this broadly defined community, got very excited about what this might mean. Other times there's been blood moons, red moons. And of course, the fact that this all this is happening when Russia is at war and when Israel is under attack and attacking its neighboring territory of Gaza. All of this feeds into this apocalyptic mindset. There is the American culture, really, from the inauguration of the colonies in the early 1600s, it's got this incredible build-up of apocalyptic pressure that just erupts every so often. We can see it in the Civil War period, we can see it during World War One, we can see it during the Cold War, we can see it at Gulf War One, and so on. You know, it just bursts up, and politicians, of course, know how to use that very effectively. So Darby would not want to be held responsible for these things because he was, although he was evangelical in theology, he was very much opposed to evangelicalism. Although he called believers to come out of churches, he was certainly not interested in total egalitarianism. You know, he really did believe that the ministers of the word had authority as preachers. Although he was interested in the end of the world, he did not believe there were any signs of the times to look for. And although he certainly expected some political things to happen, including the breakup of the British Empire, the division of the United Kingdom, Irish independence, the formation of a European superstate, the re-establishment of the State of Israel, although he expected all of these things, even in the mid-19th century, he would never have encouraged anyone to cast a vote to make them happen, because he was resolutely opposed to democracy. And that, for me, is the irony of Darby's legacy, that he is co-opted by a religious movement that has turned a theological definition of itself, evangelicalism, which was a community once known in theological terms, but which is increasingly a political or even economic community. But they are co-opting and appropriating his name, his legacy, some of his arguments to advance ends that he could never have approved of. So, is Darby the father of dispensationalism? Maybe it's uncle. Is he the father of Christian Zionism? I think that's a really difficult question to answer, because he was not at all in favor of any kind of political action. Events will take their own course, he would have said, and believers should just sit back and wait for Jesus. Live faithfully, live pious lives, be kind to your neighbors, love your enemies, do all of the things that Christians ought to do. But fundamentally, Christians are not here to change the world. Jesus will come back and change the world. We just have to wait for that to happen. I think that's what he would say.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. And you know, it's clear that his ideas and his thinking has had a profound influence on the United States, on different sects of Christianity. But it's also, you know, it's always fascinating to see the compare the how someone's legacy or how someone's ideas get modified or you know, misinterpreted over the years, maybe for opportunistic reasons. But it's really quite fascinating. I think Darby, you know, coming away from this, Darby really seems to be a figure that has had an outsized influence on history. Well, Crawford, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. It was really fantastic to speak with you about Jan Darby and the roots of dispensationalism. You know, really wonderful to have you, and thanks for the participation that you have in New Books Network.
Thank you for your time, Caleb. I really appreciate the invitation.
Of course.